I'm Will Hertzfeld, and I'm from Oakland, California. In the late 60s, when Tress and Martin and Catherine and Stephen and I first came to this village, we all have vivid memories of coming up the lake, and even before we had read that prayer about Abraham and Sarah being called to places that they had no idea about, and certain predilections about encountering strange and unusual goings on. We knew how they might have felt. It was, as I've heard some of the new Holdenites here describe it, quite a trip. Nothing was familiar to us. We'd never been on a boat like the Lady of the Lake, or later on, Lady of the Lake changing into the Happy Exchange. Some of the old timers remember those days, you know, when Holden owned its own boat, had its own captain, etc. Those were great days. But back to the first time we came here. When we approached the dock down there, we saw two familiar faces, Jenny and Elmer Witt, who had arranged for us to come to this place shortly after the Missouri Synod Convention in Denver in 1969. And we remember how happy we were to see them. During the next month that we spent in this village, we thought several times about having had that experience, and having had that experience translate itself into some difficult times in this village, because you see, we were the first black family to come here, and that's quite a burden. And so we used to walk around the village saying things like, well, there are five of us and 400 of them. That makes that makes it about equal. And the experiences here have now led to these moments. And I don't want to take a lot of time reminiscing or dreaming about those days, because we want to do some hard talk about Holden Village within the context of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Probably want to talk about the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America within the context of a world of living color and stereophonic sound, and all of the beauties of the creative genius of God. How we might embrace that, and how we might continue to be beneficiaries of it in spite of our own sinfulness and our own shortcomings, and all of the other things that we confess in those breastfeeding sessions at the first part of the Green Book for those who are Lutherans. And for those who are not, you've got your colors and your ways of doing that also. We want to invite also those who have identified with other sects to participate in the discussion, and consider yourself qualified to help us evangelical Lutherans to maybe understand ourselves a little better, and as a consequence of understanding ourselves a little better, understand our mission a little better, and embrace it joyfully. Well, where to begin? I think that this particular period, covering approximately the next 2 weeks, is a critical one in the life of the church. For indeed, there are some discussions, and I hope creative confrontations that will go on here that I'll be interested in. Unfortunately, I'll have to listen to the tapes and subject myself to rumors of those days because of my need to depart and continue with conventions and meetings. But I want to say some things which may have some bearing on our discussions. First of all, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America actually has a genesis that extends itself beyond, and that is backwards in time, the event at Columbus. That is when the three presiding bishops carried these, some of you have seen the pictures, these 45-pound water jugs to the baptismal font and began pouring. And then, you know, people have reminded me that the expression on my face was an expression that said something like, I may get a hernia. Or you think about these 45-pound water jugs, and you figure that this particular symbolic act was designed for a 6'8" Aryan, and not a 5'7" black person. But that event, with all of its symbolic value, and it is unparalleled, had some other beginnings. And I suppose that we would want to start with the old Commission for Lutheran Unity and the very first encounter with a question of what kind of church did we think the people wanted. And our conclusion was, on the basis of polls and other things, was that the people wanted a new Lutheran church in America, and they wanted that church to be different from the preceding church bodies in style, in makeup, and in a number of other ways. I'm going to elect now to just talk about one component of that church, incidentally, and I believe that component may be the only new thing about the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, at least at this point. It resulted in two additions to the structure of the church, and those additions are the Commission for Women and the Commission that is multicultural, or the Multicultural Commission. From the very beginning, if you read newspapers of both from outside the church and from inside the church, I remember one headline said, "There's a flap over quotas." the question of whether or no the church would impose certain things upon itself in regards to the question of inclusiveness. Now, that may be the last time you'll hear me use that word, primarily because I have some problems with the word inclusive, much in the same way that some of us, at the time that we came up this up the lake, were beginning to have some problems with the word integration. You remember I said there are five of us and 300 of them. That's hardly integration talk. It's not separatistic talk, but it's hardly integration talk. And the use of the word inclusive, at least through the eyes of those of us who are persons of color, or who are persons whose for whom English is the second language, is that the concept may have been taken away from us again and given a definition and a meaning and become the victim of a process over which we have little or no control, just as integration was taken from us. We have not had a chance to define what we mean by it beyond the point at which I'm going to talk in a few minutes. But the flap over inclusiveness had to do with the request of a group of persons who called themselves multicultural, because they were, a request to the old Committee on Lutheran Unity that when the directions were given to the conventions of the AELC, ALC, and LCA, that is the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches, the American Lutheran Church, and the Lutheran Church in America, that when these instructions were given, that the instructions include certain provisions for the conventions of those churches to elect to the commission for a new Lutheran church a truly, truly inclusive group of 70 who would then begin the arduous task of designing this new Lutheran church in America. The person of color who was on that, and there was one person of color who was on that commission, bled and nearly died because of the initial request from the group that who asked him to do it and commissioned him to do it, was that it'd be 33% persons of color and persons whose language, whose second language was English. The negotiation process over a period of a year resulted then in a mandate to the conventions of 10% persons of color. And our formula was not just dealing with persons of color, but dealt with the question of the representation of women in church, and also the representation of lay persons. The formula was, as it was designed, was an inclusive formula. Conventions voted it, and the commission was created, and there began the work of creating the new church. This commission of 70, having had a good experience with having been created as a result of the quota system, elected then to pass their joy on to the churches. And if you'll recall, several times there were attempts to reject that particular quota system, but each time it came back from the churches saying to the commission, change it. The commission determined that it was the will of God. Always a good position to take. that it not be changed. And in the meantime, there was a group that was created outside of the commission. Those persons are persons whom I consider to be, at least for these historical moments, the unsung heroines and heroes who hung around us from the time that they were organized, gave parties, talked to us, encouraged us, strengthened us, and then promised to be with us when we went into the three conventions of the church, and they were this group of persons who identified themselves as a group with a justice agenda. Some of those people are in this room, and it's good to have all those people here to reflect at least on where all of this work has gotten us up to this point. That's a brief and thumbnail sketch of how we got to what is now the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and what the results have been now of some several months of elections, organizing, etc. Let me say that all of the boards and commissions of the church are really things of beauty to behold. All of them, without exception. There are all of the colors of the rainbow and more on those boards and commissions. So one could say that those who have been selected, elected by the conventions, by the convention in Columbus, and since appointed by the church council, have been truly representative of what the church is and what we would hope that the church will be. So the system worked. And we are pleased for it, and already the experiences of persons of color and with English as a second language, and those persons described as the dominant Lutheran group have been having some pleasant surprises, getting to know each other and struggling with certain kinds of sensitivities which the Lutheran churches in this country heretofore have never had. Jim Andrews, stated clerk of the Presbyterian Church, says, "Will, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is now the envy of all Protestantism. We did not know that you could pull it off." Avery Post, the head of the UCC Church, with whom I'm in league on several other boards and assignments of national and international import. Avery was the USA head of the Harare U.S. delegation to Harare, which I served on, and I understand that Steve has discussed the Harare statement here and so forth with you. So Avery is a person with whom I have shared some toils and snares, and whom I respect very highly. He said, I would hope that mergers that will follow will at least attempt to do it the way the Lutherans have done it. So what else is there to say about the ELCA and the beginning of the rainbow? Well, it's one thing to talk about those who are elected and those who are volunteers in the church, and to celebrate that kind of reality. And it's another thing now to look at the work that has to be done. There are 12 boards in the new church, 5 committees, that is standing committees, and all of those boards are in place, and I think at least, you know, I'm happy with them, and there are many who say that I've been the toughest one to satisfy. But there's trouble in our church already. The election of bishops signal a part of that trouble. Of all of the bishops elected, and they've all been elected now with the exception of three, there are no persons of color in the continental United States. Within the continental United States, there are no women. And of course, we never intended to have lay people elected as bishops. What does that mean? I think that poses for us some key analytical problems. And I'd like for us to talk about those. I could talk about them. I could talk about them for an hour and a half, but then, or more. But I'd like to discuss that reality with you. It's something that's troubling the church. There's a great deal of bitterness and animosity. There's a great deal of frustration, and what some black persons, for example, on the south side of Chicago would describe as triple frustration. You know, a celebration of the reality that we do have an inclusive church, you know, with all these hundreds of people elected and selected, you know, representing the rainbow. But at the same time, the democratic process does not allow for a similar kind of reality to emerge. The one bishop who is a person of color is the Bishop of Puerto Rico, an interesting kind of Caribbean Synod is called, Caribbean Synod. It's an interesting kind of election. He will be the youngest bishop of all of the bishops that have been elected. So the one person of color from off the continental shelf will be a 30-year-old man. And the tragi-humorous statement is that, well, this one bishop who's a person of color, at least so far, you know, unless something happens with the other three, may have a chance to see an awful lot of the older, of his older white colleagues die. It's a macabre sense of humor. It's not funny, you know. Unless, of course, you know, one operates with the basic presupposition that all of these bishops will be saved when they die, thereby going to a better place, in which case we can celebrate. That's one problem. The other problem has to do with the selection of executive directors. And I just want to give you a box score because, unfortunately, you know, the box scores tell us more than a lecture would, since we are now a data-oriented society. Just want the facts, ma'am. Just the facts. You know, even the old Sergeant Friday and the new Sergeant Friday, you know, picks up that one. For the executive directors, for all of the boards and commissions, we have one person of color selected, and his selection was predictable. Why? Because that's the person who will direct the multicultural unit. You got to remember now, and the names that came to the transition team that came up through the interview process, there were two persons of color nominated. Both of them were nominated for the multicultural unit, so we had to select one of those, thereby guaranteeing that we would have a person of color. Two women were selected as executive directors. You might guess that both of those have something to do with women's work in one way or another. Women's work, what is that? That's a real question. I think that we have to debate that. Now, of course, parliamentarily at this point, while it's very much into my consciousness, I would ask for purposes of discussion, though at this point, that we divide the question. And I'm sure you would understand why it is that I want to divide the question, except for when we talk, about the fact that there are women of color also. And three or four lay persons. Now those who were selected before this round of meetings, which Joe Barnett and I just attended, is fresh in our consciousness. I mean, we saw it all happening in Chicago. It was last week, wasn't it? Yeah. Last week in Chicago. Those who were selected before were four clergy, all white, three laypersons, all white, two women, white, and no persons of color. Now this group of persons selected before are persons who to be editor of the magazine, single election at Columbus, and a series of assistants for the bishop of the New Lutheran Church, Bishop Herbert Chilstrom's assistants are all white, and but a proper balance of male and female, at least according to the women at this point, but still all white, no persons of color. Question of clarification?
How many executive directors are there altogether?
There are 12 boards and commissions, so we're talking about 12 executive directors.
So one out of 12.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I'm just curious, are any of those Hispanic? When you say
no
person of color, you mean black?
No, I meant when I say person of color, say it. In fact, I have a note here that says whenever you talk persons of color from this point on, it might be best not to say persons of color, but say Asian, Black, Hispanic, Native American. That's what I mean.
Yeah. But no Hispanic.
No. There are other positions that I've named here other than executive directors, because there are top executive positions that also are connected to the office of the bishop, like the executive director for ecumenical affairs, the executive director of the planning, and finance unit, the treasurer. Of the church is not an elected position, but also a selected position, because the treasurer is also the executive director of finance. Those kinds of executive directors. So there were four or five of them. So we're talking about 12 directors in the unit in the units, and then we're talking about four or five other executive director types. Selected or nominated by the bishop to the church council. So it's one out of 12 would be one equation when you're talking about the boards and the commissions. One out of 16 would be more apropos. That's the box score. That ought to trouble Holdenites. And it ought to trouble all of us who are here to experience what it means to be people of the rainbow. Or another way of saying, people of the promise. Now a couple of paragraphs. Harry Edwards. None of you probably have heard of Harry Edwards. Well, one of you have. Two of you have, maybe. Harry Edwards is a professor at the University of California. And Harry and I have been working together on a couple of projects in the Bay Area for a number of years now. One of which, of course, is a problem where we're sensing some success, but it's still a very, very excruciating and agonizing process. And that is, we're working with young black males who suddenly find themselves to be millionaires, mostly in the National Basketball Association. And when they've got several million dollars, and let's say they come from Jackson, Mississippi, I'm picking on Jackson, Mississippi, although the one NBA player that I know well from Jackson, Mississippi, you know, is a Lutheran and therefore saved, you know, from any of these kinds of things. But we'll pick on Jackson, Mississippi. And you have all this money, and you can bet that somebody's going to have 1,001 suggestions as to what you should do with it. And it's usually cocaine or some other superficial way of achieving what everybody wants. And that's a high. I ran into Harry, as I have several times recently, in airports. We've seen each other in the Minneapolis airport, we've seen each other in the Oakland airport, we've seen each other in New York airport, and we saw each other just recently in the Chicago airport. And Harry said to me, "Will, what are you doing these days? You know, you're still trying to get a quota going in that church of yours, huh?" And I said, said, yeah. Harry said, "Well, how you doing?" I said, "Man, we're really doing great with the selections." You know, I told him all about the Columbus thing, and he said, "Wow." You know, and then I said, "But Harry, we got some..."
"Because we're not getting elected bishop, and we're not being selected executive director." And he said, "Is that right?" Said, "So y'all get selected for all the volunteer positions, right?" I said, "Yep." He said, "Well, Will, I'll tell you what you need, you know, is to have one of your boys go on Nightline like Al Campanis did and talk about yo and say, you know, the reason that blacks and persons of color are not being selected for executive director positions and for bishops of the church is that they just don't have the capacity for performing such chores. Therefore, you know, a person like that, if it's the right person," he said, "you know, ask your bishop to do it." And then I think that you might get some results in a few years. At least, Will, you will be offered a job, as I have, by the baseball commissioner now, to go and find some blacks for the front office. It was 40 years ago that Jackie Robinson broke into baseball. 40 years. And in the process of celebrating the 40th anniversary of Jackie Robinson's entrance into baseball, Al Campanis was chosen as one of the people, because he's connected with the Dodgers, the now Los Angeles Dodgers, to be one of the people to comment. And I've never seen a more shocked expression on Ted Koppel's face. You know, it's hard to shock Ted Koppel, for those of you who watch Nightline. And I don't think that there's anybody alive who does not watch Nightline. Is there anybody here who does not watch Nightline? I mean... You people spend all your time in Holland Village?
We can hide
here. I remember Ted Koppel saying, "Mr. Campanis, you've just dug a hole for yourself, sir, by talking about these, you know, diminished capacity on the part of these people, that they don't have the intellectual equipment to manage and to be, you know, to be in the front office. I want to give you a chance to get out of it." And Campanis just kept digging the hole. Now that, of course, has set off, you know, all kinds of explosions around the country 40 years after Jackie Robinson entered baseball. Now I have dates of the entrance of the first black clergy person into the Lutheran Church, since we're going to measure this by clergy persons. I also have dates of the first Hispanic person to become a Lutheran. I also have not of the first Native person, but of the first Native congregation that became Lutheran in this country. I also have the date when my grandmother made a political decision to become a Lutheran in the late 1800s in Dallas County, Alabama. Now that was in, just before 1906 when my father was born, that she made that decision. And from that point until now, the struggle is on. Well, one could draw attention to oneself and one could say, what about the two black bishops? To which I will respond, now don't Nelson Trout or Will Hertzfeld this issue, because they, you know, they can't help this one right now. The problem is one of deciding what it is that we will do with the question that's in front of us. One question, two parts. Let me just read now. I don't like to read to people, as some of you know, but I thought I'd read this one. It's from the Seminarian. It's Lutheran Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. Just to try to find out where some of the problems might be. Give us some clues. A professor at the Philadelphia Seminary, who was a candidate for a bishop in one of our synods, wrote an article in the Seminarian that has created quite a stir, at least among persons of color. In fact, it's being passed from house to house now, kind of like Frantz Fanon's book. Wretched of the Earth was passed, back in the late 50s, early 60s. But he writes an article, first of all, saying that the hermeneutic, that's a way of interpreting and a way of understanding, it's a heavy theological term, the hermeneutic of charity ought to replace the hermeneutic of suspicion. And then he said, all this liberation talk and quota talk and those kinds of talks, you know, have created a hermeneutic of suspicion in the church, thereby suggesting that any discussion of the election of bishops or any discussion of the selection of executive directors might lead to the development of a hermeneutic of suspicion, which then would set race relations back. Set it back. One of the students then responds, and it's a student with a very colorful name. Her first name is Violet. And she writes, and I'll read it almost in its entirety. In a recent article in the Seminarian, the question was raised, why is it that our common life has been seemed so divisive, so brittle, so fragmented in these last 3 years, the years of the development of the new church? As a student who's been taking classes at this institution 3 years ago, I've also asked this question, though from a slightly different perspective. Upon my arrival here, I was amazed at the ease with which everyone declared themselves sinners. It seemed that I could barely have lunch in the refectory without some sort of reminder of the sinful state of my existence. What I found even more astonishing, however, was the simultaneous denial of the sins themselves. As soon as a sin was named, be it from the sin of racism or sexism or any other form of separation from God, fear arose, defenses became high, and ways were sought to place the blame somewhere else. With much pain, I remember overhearing a conversation that took place between two students one morning. They were discussing the black problem on campus. One student jokingly said, "The solution is simple. Make this an all-white seminary." I recall this incident, not with self-righteousness or accusation, but with a great deal of sorrow that I did not confront these students at that time. What of making the Conference of Bishops all white? What of making all of the executive directors, with the exception of the one that's obviously compartmentalized, and with the exception of the one bishop off the continental shelf, what of making these high, visible, and very powerful offices all white and predominantly male? Is that the beginning of the rainbow? Or could it be the beginning of the end of the rainbow? That's the question. My mental jury, quite frankly, is still out on it. I think that there's work to be done. And I think that some of that work might well be done here in the village this week. There are all kinds of solutions that are being suggested to the problem, and I'll tell you those so that we don't have to spend too much time discussing them. Yes, we are thinking about placing persons of color behind each one of the executive directors you know, so that when these executive directors pass on, people of color will move forward. We've thought about that one already. The trick is, you know, is how to get them there, you know, and then how to get these executive directors to move on. You know, some of these people have a history of long life. And, you know, because they were not subjected to the ravages of infant mortality and some of the direct results of oppression and systematic disenfranchisement. And one of those direct results is, of course, early death. I think I'll stop. I plan to talk for 30 minutes. I think I've been relatively successful in doing that, 45 minutes. Yeah. But I should stop now, and we can talk. Yes, sir.
I have a question. I'm not Lutheran.
Good.
Who elects the bishops and the other?
Yeah, the bishops are elected. The bishops are elected by the regional units that we call synods. And there are some 65 of these synods that were built into the design of the new church. So it's an efficient way of doing local and regional work and caring, you know, for the base of the church, which is the congregation. So it's like a three-tiered bureaucracy. Synods and proposed regional group, which is a group of synods, and then the national expression of the church.
So the congregations do have a vote, but it goes to
the congregations. The congregations send delegates to the synodical convention, who are now organizing the synods.
So who were the delegates from each congregation? There was a quota type in there too.
Yes, there was.
What's the structure of that? One lay, one.
No.
Not that.
All of the clergy on the staff of a congregation are delegates. All clergy, huh?
With one vote.
No. The clergy get each person gets it's one person one vote, clergy, and then lay persons are elected according to the size of the congregation. For example, I think you start with two, and then you get one for every 50 additional persons there are in the congregation, or something like that. Excuse me, I lost a zero. Go ahead. Did you have some?
No, I thought that there was some that one person had to be a woman from the congregation.
Our congregation had two delegates, and one was male and one was female.
Mm-hmm.
And if we could manage something else, we were supposed to do that too.
Okay. Problem is that many of the congregations don't have persons of color. The quota system relative to male, female, lay clergy, I think, is holding in most congregations.
Actually, the problem is not that most congregations don't have persons of color, it's that most congregations don't see that their lack of persons of color is a problem.
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah.
The use of quotas was narrowly, it was a fairly narrow decision.
The use of quotas was used much narrowly when it got to the level of congregations and synods than it was in terms of the national churches.
I'm just wondering if we had not, I mean, that was a fragile decision in some ways, and if that had not happened, if resulted in the same way that the other process did, of election of bishops, that it would have, we would not have seen the kind of representation.
That's a point I was making early on,
yeah.
That for those of us who felt that we had to impose something on ourselves because we could not trust ourselves to do the right thing, we've been vindicated already. It's a price that we had to pay, but we knew, as now I'm speaking for persons of color, we knew what the results would be anyway.
I said, surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Why didn't the staff positions take that same role? I mean, at the executive, well, I see the bishop side, but I suppose that's a the election of a bishop. I see no problem with setting a quota system. Like maybe even the people in their own areas would have some feeling about that, but why in the executive positions was that not on a... Why wasn't that done at the same time?
The clearance of the names of persons through the interview panels was critical. Persons of color and women, with some few exceptions, found it very difficult to make it into and out of those panels.
How do you see the future, that say the immediate future, will black congregations and Hispanic congregations and maybe even congregations that have a majority of women in them continue to have kind of a Cinderella status in the church? Because I think they kind of have to up to this point.
That's a good question. I don't want to speak to all these questions. Somebody else want to comment on that? I think that's an excellent question.
Could you repeat the question?
They want to hear the question again.
With the election of all white officers for the new church, will that indicate that black or Hispanic congregations, or perhaps even congregations made up mostly of women, will have a kind of Cinderella status, as they seem to have in the past in the Lutheran Church?
It means your chariot turns to pumpkin at convention time, or... I don't know if these congregations will have, I don't know if they will have a Cinderella status. So someone, as I said, you know, you're all invited to participate in these answers. I think that these congregations will be, as some of them already are, in a struggling mode. And it's not an attempt to justify continuation of the church. That's not the debate at all. None of us are ready to leave it. We certainly have not entertained those kinds of possibilities, at least not at the stage that we are now. There were times when we did, but we have not. We are hopeful that that the church will be sensitive to what has happened, and that certain adjustments will be made. We are also assured of the fact that there are cadres of people
all over this country who are committed already now to seeing change in the ELCA, even prior to its formal beginning. But then we were not, as I said, and as you affirmed, we were not surprised by this reality. But then, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when my brother called and said that my father was going to die, you know, I was not too surprised by it when my father died. I was surprised at the time that he died, you know, while I was, you know, on my way home to pack to go to see him. But I was not surprised by it. But the non-surprise nevertheless does not eliminate, you know, the basic shock to the system. You know, even though you're expecting it, when it happens, you don't want it to happen because it hurts.
Just to go, just to talk about that surprise, in Chicago, you know, there was no surprise. I knew who was going to be bishop, or, you know, it's not going to be black. But on the first ballot, you know, the black has way more votes, so you get a little, you know. Second ballot, oh yeah, oh wow, this might happen, who knows? Third ballot, fourth ballot, fifth ballot, you know, you have the white male and a woman and a black person. And very clearly, the black person has more credentials, has worked with the city of Chicago, and so we were all really pretty sure at this point. The woman drops out. So there's only the black male and the white male. White male has been in Chicago just a number of couple of years, but the black male has credentials, knows Chicago, and then you come out with the white male winning. So that hurt, you know. I wasn't as hurt as most people because I didn't have, you know, I kind of knew what was going to happen. But when you have people working and for that to happen, and black loses by 13 points, that's some of the hurt that he talked about that's still very, very fervent in Chicago. So. And I'm not as embittered as a lot of them are because I knew what was going to happen in the first place. I'm older or something. But you do get that excitement. And so that's what's happening there.
Yes.
What do you think could be accomplished at Holden in the next couple of weeks?
Hold that question. Jody, you want to answer that question?
No.
Oh, okay. Someone want to speak to that question?
Well.
What do you expect to happen? Yes.
I think that a lot of, I have a master's degree in international administration. I've gone to different countries. I've been a minority in Africa, and I have been in many different places, and dialogue always seemed to be the place we have to begin. And to impose change from the outside into the churches, it doesn't mean anything to the person that sits in the pew every Sunday until there is that dialogue that says, me to you, I speak to you, you speak to me. You're not what I thought you were. You're better, worse, whatever. Your warts are the same as my warts. We have something very common and very important to say to each other. And that's what Holden has always been, is a forum like this to break down all those built up faults, in many ways, impressions of each other. And are continually, when you have the opportunity to sit down and talk, surprised. The joy of Holden is that every day is a surprise. And every conversation is a surprise in many times and many ways. And it's this kind of dialogue that I think needs to be done on the grassroots level that will get the change to take place. And the frustration and the deep sadness that I'm feeling right now about it is very sad to me. I am concerned. And I want to be a part of the new church, and I want to see it happen. And I am so proud that the Lutherans would do that, you know. But it is such a trial to your soul to hear people continue to fall back into intellectual terms or into political status or whatever, when the business of the church is a one-on-one dialogue, a soul-to-soul discussion of our faith, of our belief, and what we commonly hold to be the things that we all believe. We say we believe together. And to reach out and not have to compartmentalize into all these commissions that separate the women's work from the multicultural work. It's all of our work. And Holden is a place to begin to break down by talking, by listening.
Rainbow on the Mountain is a most artificial thing. By artificial, I don't mean that negatively. I mean that positively. An artifact is, by definition, you know, a work of art. So this whole experience is one that's contrived. You know, there have been conspiracies, you know, going on. You know, literally, people breathing together, you know, to provide this kind of an experience. So that's why I say that you know, some of us place an awful lot of stock in these next few days. Not that they're going to be earth-shaking. I don't think that the top of this mountain is going to go off like St. Helens or. It may, but I doubt that we'll have that kind of sign. But this community, you know, is a part of what it is that's emerging, and it is appropriate and I think critical that these kinds of dialogues be held here, primarily because this is one of the few places where you can have this kind of an artificial, you know, way of doing it. Different than doing it superficially. So that's why I place some hope in the discussions for the next 2 weeks, and I'm actually jealous of not being able to participate in them. Where people can, let it all hang out. You know, already you can sense that there are some people in this room who are angry, you know, who are disappointed, you know, who are sad. You know, and there are some people who want to cry about this situation. But most importantly, I believe that there are some people who want to do what Reuel Howell calls, you know, experience in the positive sense, with all of the negative things that happen in the process, the miracle of dialogue. You know, talking about it until we are able to develop a language that communicates, and a language that communicates and enables us to use an old tired phrase, do something about it once we go back down the mountain to the reality that's there, as opposed to the artificial situation that's here. Jody.
Just a brief comment, not maybe related to the Holden Weeks. You referred briefly to the sort of life-changing impact that the experience of the Commission on the New Lutheran Church had on the people, on the 70 people who
precisely.
Did that.
Precisely. That's, right? That's that was my
point. That was an artifice, too.
Yes, it was created deliberately for that purpose. It
I
was an
talked
artifice.
To any commissioner who doesn't refer to that as an absolutely stunningly important set of experiences, both
precisely.
The joy and the tension.
Precisely.
So there's a sense in which these 2 weeks at Holden are like that, right?
Yeah.
An introduction of the joy and the tension of multicultural attempts, right, and all of their clumsiness, which most of us in this ever more segregated society over the last 25 years don't get to experience very often.
That's right. And the emphasis, you know, is on rainbow, primarily because that's where we are these days. You know, I come from, you know, a particularity, and I'm going to come out of that particularity, but I'm bringing something to what I call, you know, the rest of the people of the promise. And I'm prepared, as I'm sure all of you are, to struggle with that. Other questions or statements? Yes?
The image of the rainbow is kind of interesting to put next to the image of the melting pot that we talk about through the past years of history in the United States. It might be interesting for us to talk sometime about what that.
Oh, yes, I'd love to have you talk sometime about that. Are you going to be around for a few days? Good. Because I'd love to have you talk about that. Yes. Because I think that the melting pot theory is a very destructive and misleading theory. You know, it comes from Ford Motor Company, you know. Oh, yeah, you know, Ford Motor Company had as a part of its advertising thing, you know, in fact, there was a film made of it. You know, all of these people from all over the world, you know, they came in muumuus and boobas, and boobas is African garment, you know, and some of them didn't have any clothes on because they came from places where the climate, you know, enabled people to enjoy life without, you know, fashion designs and stuff, but they all went into this pot, a huge pot, and there's this executive type, you know, up there stirring, you know, and then when they come out of the pot, they're all dressed in coveralls with Ford stamped on them. They're
for a definition of a melting pot recently. That's where the folks on the bottom get burned and the scum rises to the top.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I heard that too, but I guess, you know, sometimes one does not have the intestinal fortitude to make certain kinds of statements, but since you said it, yes, I agree 100% with you. But you know, the United States of America and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and all of its institutions, you know, we are not a melting pot, but we are rather a stew of indigestible, insoluble lumps, thank God, which makes a kind of stew that tastes good.